Well, completing those four Britain folk song arrangements, we heard The Last Rose of Summer, before it, Oft in the Stilly Night, and the first two in the group were The Sally Gardens and O Can Ye Sew Cushions. Jennifer Johnston was the mezzo-soprano and Alistair Hogarth the pianist. And you may like to know that Jennifer Johnston will be appearing at the Proms on Wednesday evening when she sings the four last songs by Ralph Vaughan Williams. And that's the first performance of a new orchestral arrangement of them, commissioned by the BBC from Anthony Payne. It's in the second half of a BBC Symphony Orchestra concert conducted by Osmo Vanska, which also includes Goretzky's Third Symphony and Tchaikovsky's Sixth, the Pathétique. That's Wednesday evening's Prom at the usual time of 7:30. Well, before that, we've a Bruckner Symphony to look forward to tomorrow night from the Oslo Philharmonic, and another one on Friday evening.
On Friday night, one of the world's great orchestras, the Vienna Philharmonic, comes to the Proms. Lorin Maazel directs them in Anton Bruckner's towering Symphony No. 8, composed as a conscious tribute to three great Austro-German masters. Before that, we'll hear music by J.S. Bach, played on Bruckner's own organ, which still towers over every Prom in the Royal Albert Hall. Join me, Donald MacLeod, for The Proms, live from the Royal Albert Hall, Friday night at 7:30, here on BBC Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's now exactly 10:15. And a few minutes later than advertised, let's hear some highlights now from a Proms Plus late event recorded last Friday night in the Elgar Room at the Royal Albert Hall. It's introduced by Georgia Mann.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's Proms Plus Late, where poetry meets jazz in a warm late night embrace here in the Royal Albert Hall's Elgar Room. Oh yes. Outside, the famished horn of the hunter's moon is high in the sky. And there is a good reason for that seemingly gratuitous quote from Yeats right there, and it's because tonight's band, Blue Eyed Hawk, are named after a line in one of his poems, Under the Moon. And it is a suitable moniker, I can tell you, for a band who often use poetry as a sort of springboard for their music making. We're very pleased to be saying hello again to Lauren Kinsella. And tonight, she is alongside trumpeter Laura Jurd, who has the Dankworth Prize for Jazz Composition and last year's Worshipful Company of Musicians Awards, clinking alongside each other on her mantelpiece. And then, not to be outdone, drummer Corey Dick was named Young Scottish Jazz Musician of the Year earlier this month. And guitarist Alex Roth, the awards just keep coming. He is also a Dankworth Prize winner. And Jazzwise magazine, a couple of years back now, marked him out as one of the hot young players who look set to fire up the jazz scene in the future. And versifying for us this evening is Charlotte Higgins, who returns us again to that nation of poets. She's from Belfast in Northern Ireland this time. And despite only being in her third year of undergraduate studies, Charlotte is already scaling the poetic heights. She's been commended in the Foyle Young Poet of the Year Awards. She appeared at Poetry Parnassus alongside the late, great Seamus Heaney. And she's even managed to be given the job of poet in residence at Cambridge University's Archaeology and Anthropology Museum. We'll hear from Charlotte in a little while, but starting us off tonight, we have music from Blue Eyed Hawk.
Where troubles melt like lemon drops, away above the chimney tops, it's where you'll find me. your dream really do come true. Someday I'll wish upon a star, wake up where the clouds fall behind me. Where troubles smell like lemon drops and way above the chimney tops is where you'll find me. Wake up where the clouds are far behind me, where troubles melt like lemon drops away above the chimney tops. That's where
A couple of years ago, I won the Poetry Society's performance poetry competition, which is called Slambassadors. And in the workshop following winning the prize, I was challenged to write a poem from the perspective of a British soldier serving in Northern Ireland, which is where I grew up. And this is the poem I wrote. No blacks, no dogs, no Irish. That's what the sergeant said. And we never thought to doubt him. No blacks, no dogs, no Irish. Now the old dog dozes by the fire and the flame bathes amber across his black and tan coat. No blacks, no dogs, no Irish. That night the street was silent. The tower blocks grave as tombstones in the distance, the twin barbed wire halos above Divis and the comforting weight of the rifle in my clenched fists. It was after curfew. She had her high heels, silver buckles on the toes held in one hand. I called after her, British Army, stop, ma'am. It was after curfew and we'd lost a man, a boy from our unit a few days past. The shock of the carbon blast had rocked the station from outside. We ran out to sea, and the blaze burned its image behind my eyes. She was wearing an orange blouse. And it was after curfew. I said it again. I said, I order you to stop. And in the grasping shadow of the tower block, she froze. And then she ran. I had ordered her to stop. But she stopped at once on the second shot. Rouge-lined lips in the neon mirror light, unforgiving. Every wrinkle lit high, each and every smudge outside the lines. Darling, you're fabulous. And I am. Center stage in industrial strength stilettos and layer on layer of rainbow soft silk, strutting the same old stuff every night for their ready adulation. Darling, You're fabulous. And I am. But some nights fabulous fades away in a blur of eyeshadow and affectation, and the cheap cracked mirror frowns back a bloke in a dress and some lipstick and precious little foundation. But darling, you're fabulous. And I suppose I am. Just ask the blokes who sneer in the street, what are you supposed to be, love? How would a queen like you know how to fight, darlings, I say. You wouldn't want to meet a queen like me on a dark street at night, and darlings, sometimes I'm fabulous. But sometimes, I think they're right. This is the last poem. It's about I Have a Dream speech. I wrote it for a poetry organisation called Apples and Snakes, who had an event last Wednesday to celebrate the anniversary of being exactly 50 years to the day since Martin Luther King made the speech. It is called 20th of August, 1963. 50 years ago, last Wednesday, one man had a dream of one day standing in the Capitol and hearing freedom ring like thunder from the Colorado Rocky Mountain sides, like a new wind blowing through the upstate New York pines, like many colored voices speaking out for all of us, as clear as one small woman's voice once did on an Alabama bus. And now we need to hear all of our voices, because I have heard so many people say, you don't know. Man, you can't talk about race if you're not black, or feminism if you're not a woman, or LGBT rights if you're not gay. But if we create a reality where our voices can only speak out against oppression that personally concerns us, when they come for me, aren't I going to be standing here lonely? And didn't Martin Luther King himself say, many of our white brothers, as evidenced by their presence here today, have come to realize that their destiny is tied up with our destiny, that we cannot walk alone. And it doesn't matter what country you call home, not one of us was born guilty, any more than the Aryan babies in Nazi Germany were born with gas chambers and their smiles, or any clue of the horrors that have been seen with their country's eyes. Look, my dad's family come from Donegal, and the hillsides in that part of the country are scar-lined with famine walls, but I don't have those same scars here on my body. I cannot carry my ancestors' anguish around with me. Old pain, like old guilt, is too heavy. And the risk is that if we carry old angers like chains round our hands, we can never then reach out for anything. If we keep our lungs tightened with second-hand hatred, then how can we hope that they'll sing? And if we think that we're somehow honouring days of old when we use our country's flags as red rags or as blindfolds, then we're wrong. And there is nothing wrong with feeling love for your country. For me, it comes from standing as far north in Ireland as it is possible to go, where the crash of the slate-grey waves on the shore is a rhythm I feel in my bones, and it's a Belfast pub and a guy with a flat cap rasping rebel songs into your microphone. But that's just the version of human that I know best as home. And we can call it all kinds of things, love or hope or justice or equality, but what it comes down to is as simple and gorgeous as common humanity. Because it doesn't matter what country we call home, we are not going anywhere as one race or one nation alone. And we will never honour a dream that still lives, although the words of the dreamer are now 50 years in the past, until all of our voices are raised up singing, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
Charlotte Higgins. Blue-eyed hawk.
Come up here and talk to me, please.
the sounds that you produce as a vocal improviser, does poetry help you capture those? Does it enable you to kind of spring off, and does it act as a kind of springboard for those?
Yeah, I've always loved words, and even speaking them to myself. I mean, I've always loved Heaney, all these kind of poems since I was little. Even if I didn't know what they meant at first, just speaking out loud and liking how the words fitted inside my mouth and just the rhythm. And then obviously, yeah, breaking them apart, being able to work with a specific poem and randomly just picking out a few lines for that performance, because maybe those lines make more sense at that time.
And I have to ask Alex, when you're doing something like that, does one of you come up with a loose pattern, and then you just kind of, I mean, you have to have something in place, presumably, before you set off on one of those journeys?
Well, we're all improvising musicians, so one of the things that attracts us to the music that we play in this group is the fact that we can actually start with very little discussion. Like Lauren said, we play a lot of music based on the poetry of Yeats, which is also where our name comes from, as you said. And we came up with a very loose arrangement based on a poem called I Do Not Love Too Long. And what we're about to play, we've kind of taken that idea of the arrangement, and now we're sort of placing that in the context of the Heaney poem, Valediction.
And we'll hear it in just a moment, but Lauren, I can't not ask you about Seamus Heaney. I mean, why is he such a huge figure for Ireland, and why do the words mean so much for you?
He was able to speak about everything. Love, relationships, nature, what went on with his parents, rural life, the north, the collisions, that being in a wider political context, everything. For me, he's the king of Irish poetry. I mean, I love Yeats, I love Longley, I love lots of Irish poets, but I started reading that when I was in school, and it still stays with me, you know? Especially the first few collections, Death of a Naturalist, and has all those amazing poems, Twice Shy, Valediction, Midterm Break, and some of them are heartbreaking, but some of them are also, you know, really beautiful, happy poems about expression and when you fall in love with somebody for the first time. And he can just say so much on a page for me.
One of the true poets of humanity, I think it's fair to say. We're going to hear now Blue Eyed Hawk doing their version of Seamus Heaney's Valediction.
No, it's the video. Voice and voice and voice and voice.
Blue-Eyed Hawk's improvisation on Seamus Heaney's Valediction. And that ends tonight's selection of highlights from the Proms Plus Late event, which was recorded last Friday night. The poetry was written and read by Charlotte Higgins, and the programme was presented by Georgia Mann. We've a Radio 3 essay for you in a couple of minutes, and that's followed by Jazz on 3 at 11, celebrating the 60th birthday of the composer and multi-instrumentalist John Zorn. So until the essay, a little piano music by Saint-Saëns. Piano music by Camille Saint-Saëns, the first of a set of six studies for piano left hand, played by Piers Lane. And if you enjoyed Saint-Saëns' organ symphony in last night's prom, well, don't forget that you can still hear that for the next 6 days via the Radio 3 website. And if you don't have internet access, you may like to know it's being played again on Radio 3 on Friday afternoon, the whole concert given by the Paris Orchestra, conducted by Paavo Järvi, also including Britten's Violin Concerto, played by Janine Jansen, and that'll be on Friday afternoon from 2 o'clock. It's just after 10:45 this Monday night on BBC Radio 3. Time now for an essay, first broadcast in June last year. The travel writer and novelist Colin Thubron considers the need to challenge in the world of sporting endeavour.
We watch them with awe and astonishment. Years of training are culminating in a few minutes, sometimes in a few seconds, of tremendous endeavour. To spectators, the partisan impulses of the football club or rugby are largely absent. These athletes seem rather to belong to themselves or to everybody. We marvel at what our own species can do. Perhaps they enact our dreams for us. As for the athletes, their motivation, we're told, is second only to genetic gift. Success is a matter of desire, the intensity of the will. Challenge, for anyone, is the thing that you're not sure you can do. Almost by definition, it involves something attempted for the first time and may elicit either a paralysis of misgiving or a burst of adrenaline and hope. It can become an obsession, a passion, even a fear. Crucially, it's a test of self-worth. If challenge had a symbol, it would surely be a mountain. When asked why he kept returning to climb Everest, the mountaineer George Mallory, who died near the summit in 1924, was famously said to have replied, "Because it's there." Explorers and athletes are notoriously inarticulate about their motives, as well they might be. For at its purest, challenge is self-created. It is its own incentive. What can the shaving of a split second off of an Olympic sprint record mean, or the ascent of the north face of the Eiger? They are materially pointless. A few years ago, in the mountains of northwest Iran, I found myself climbing a sheer cliff face, trying to reach a fortified cave 60 feet above me. This was the only entrance I could discern to the cliff palace of Maimundiz, where, in 1256, the last master of the terrible sect of assassins had shored himself up in a futile stand against the invading Mongols. Without much hope at first, I started levering myself up a vertical crevice, then found to my alarm that the cliff was composed not of solid rock, but of coagulated sand and shale. For a while, I winched myself tentatively up, testing each foot and handheld, pausing for long minutes to calm my breath. Then, halfway up, I lost my nerve. Spread-eagled in the crevice, I looked down 30 feet to naked stone. The cliff above me was sheer. High overhead, I glimpsed the cave ceiling, still sooted with the Mongol fires of over 7 centuries before. Until this moment, I think, I've been climbing in a spirit of pure curiosity. But now something else kicked in, a sense of imminent failure. The chamber above, which could only be a gutted shell, suddenly took on the possibility of an Aladdin's cave. To miss it was unbearable. I noticed my own hands clutching the rock. They were lean and no longer young. They should not be doing this. But it was too late. Foolishly, for no other reason now than a trembling response to challenge, I braced my body inside the thinning cleft and descended the last 30 feet in a mood of grim exhilaration. It was a risk utterly incommensurate with anything that could meet my gaze when I hoisted myself at last into the empty cave. However diluted by common needs, fame, money, an irreducible nugget of pride will likely remain at the heart of any such undertaking. It may touch even acts of blatant vanity or cranky masochism. The Olympian urge to be the fastest, the highest, the most enduring is shared by a host of eccentric enterprises. The Guinness World Records is full of them. There are records for everything, from the longest egg-tossing distance to the number of hot dogs consumed in 10 minutes and the most successful collector of airline sickness bags. Challenge is running amok. Somebody's claimed the record for the greatest distance travelled with a pool cue balanced on his chin. Another for the fastest half-marathon pushing a pram. To the pure athlete, of course, any artificial constraints are absurd. The temptation is rather to artificial stimulants. So, too, there are athlete travellers whose feats require no handicap to make them daunting. They ski down Everest, or kayak round Japan, or windsurf the Atlantic. To me, while travelling, the vicissitudes of challenge have become an intrinsic need. I need them for the value of the words I will bring back. Experience in an alien, sometimes hostile, culture, even a conversation in a difficult language, holds a value, if only for its rarity, that other encounters cannot. This underlying quality, without my defining it, has driven me over the years to ever bleaker or more troubled regions of Asia, from the Middle East to the Soviet Union, Siberia, and Tibet. The old USSR and China in particular, the communist giants, the bogies of my generation that might one day swarm west and subsume us, possess the lure of the half-forbidden. Encounters here seem to be wrenched out of the shadows. Was I comforting myself by trying to familiarise the enemy, or was this need for hardship some obscure expiation? "These torturing hours of ascent seemed as though they could never end," wrote the soldier writer Patrick Lee Fermor, climbing in the Greek Taygetus Mountains. "Feet became cannonballs, Loads turned to lead. Hearts pounded. Hands slipped on the handles of sticks, and rivers of sweat streamed over burning faces and trickled into our mouths like brine. Why, we kept wondering, though too short of breath for talk, does one embark on these furious wrestling matches, these rib-cracking clinches with the sublime, felons on invisible treadmills? Our motives elude identity, and one person's travail, of course, is another's deliverance. For me, hardship has rarely seemed like itself. It has been displaced, instead, by a robust and irrational optimism. Challenge, after all, is inseparable from the lodestar of success, so spirits remain high. While motoring through the Western Soviet Union in the early 1980s, the grim Brezhnev years, I was confined by law to a handful of arterial roads. In those secretive times, the impulse to glimpse behind facades was irresistible. Just off the permitted highways, I imagined, something revelatory was going on. And from time to time, I would veer down a lesser, forbidden road, cruising into nowhere, out of an instinct that any interdiction must hide something. So I would drive through the same flatlands and forests, discovering to my chagrin that nothing was much different there, before being turned back with dashed spirits by the ubiquitous police. Paradoxically, the greatest challenge for me is to write about home, a place so well known that I can't see it clearly. I have always been haunted by a remark of Samuel Johnson, in which he mentions a traveller called Jonas Hanway, well known in his day, who made his name with an account of his journey into Russia and Persia, and was the first man in London, incidentally, to carry an umbrella. But Hanway followed up this book with a disaster called An 8 Days' Journey from Portsmouth to Kingston-upon-Thames, causing Johnson to expostulate, "Mr. Hanway made some reputation by travelling abroad, but lost it all by travelling at home." Dictionaries have defined challenge as a calling into question of anyone or anything. It has its roots in the Latin calumnia, which suggests that it was once associated with insult. At some level, this may still be so. The unmet challenge taunts or accuses us, a private calumny that yet hurts our vanity. I knew a high-caste Indian who felt so humiliated by his morbid phobia of decay that he joined a sect of despised slumdogs and spent a season burning corpses on the ghauts of Benares. But the dream of success, athletic success as much as any, can outstrip all misgiving. To hurl the furthest javelin ever hurled, to become the fastest man in the world, will, at least in the imagination, be to cross a border into an unknown country. Surely, beyond that frontier, the victor will be changed, become somebody subtly different, a hero, or at least a man or woman at peace. But, of course, the country beyond, deprived of its aspiration, is shadowy. Challenge, in miniature, is the stuff of life. Above all, it's the conceiving of a difficulty, and therefore of an opportunity, perhaps physical, perhaps artistic or scientific. Without it, there's no change, and whole civilizations relapse in the dust, condemned to torpor and repetition. In the restless Greek world, where the Olympic Games were conceived, the participating states were notoriously fractious. But while the Games were in progress, a sacred truce descended. All hostilities were suspended, and no army could penetrate the plain of Elis. Even today, around the ruins of the great Pan-Hellenic sanctuary of Olympia, the country is one of wooded peace. For a few days, this creatively competitive people, with their prickly sense of honour, sublimated their quarrels into fierce, sometimes brutal, contests in its stadium. As for the athletes, their motivation must have been peculiarly intense. A victor would return home with such honour that his triumph shed lustre on his family, his city, his whole region, and statues were likely raised to him. In his book, The Worst Journey in the World, the polar explorer Apsley Cherry-Garrard, the lone survivor of Scott's ill-fated Antarctic expedition, reflected, "Why do some human beings desire with such urgency to do such things, regardless of the consequences, voluntarily, conscripted by no one but themselves? No one knows. There's a strong urge to conquer the dreadful forces of nature, and perhaps to get consciousness of ourselves, of life, and of the shadowy workings of our human minds. Physical capacity is the only limit. I have tried to tell how and when and where, but why? That is the mystery. It's not a mystery that will preoccupy the Olympic athletes of 2012, nor does it trouble us who will watch them. The source of their dedication may be mysterious, but its will to abstract achievement is perfectly recognizable. They are giving physical expression, often in a beautiful extreme, to our shared instincts. They are our surrogates and our champions."
That was Colin Thubron on The Challenge in Sporting Endeavour. His essay originally was part of a series called A Sporting Lexicon, first broadcast here on Radio 3 in June last year, so just before last summer's Olympics, of course. And the series was produced by Duncan Menshaw. The essay is now available as a free download. For more details of that, go to the Radio 3 website. Well, no essay tomorrow night, but between our two proms, another chance to hear a feature from earlier in the year, as Matthew Sweet tells the extraordinary story of Dr. Alex Comfort, author of The Joy of Sex. Stop Calling Me Dr. Sex is our feature tomorrow night at 9:15.
At the BBC Proms, the Orchestra Sinfonica di Milano Giuseppe Verdi, under conductor Xian Zhang, completes the season's Tchaikovsky Symphony series with his Byronic Manfred.